May it please the Court, my name is Harvey P. Sackett. I appear this morning with Emily L. Wang. I represent John A. Jamieson, plaintiff and appellant in this matter. I wish to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal. This case involves Jamieson's claim for Social Security disability insurance benefits. Jamieson submits that the decision by the administrative law judge not only necessitates reversal, but additionally warrants remand for the immediate payment of benefits. Jamieson raised three main issues in his opening brief. This morning I'd like to focus on one area in particular, specifically the administrative law judge's findings regarding Jamieson's physical residual functional capacity as well as his mental residual functional capacity. Most critically, the administrative law judge placed outcome determinative reliance on the opinion of a non-examining, non-treating state agency examiner who completed a checkbox form. He did so in lieu of the residual functional capacity assessment from Dr. Cunnington, Jamieson's primary care physician. How did the ALJ purportedly reach this conclusion? He premised his conclusion on several reasons. Number one, he stated that he found Dr. Cunnington's RFC assessment to be inconsistent with the medical evidence of record and extreme. He did the same with the mental RFC assessment. I'll get to that shortly. The record doesn't support that finding. Dr. Cunnington noted diagnoses of occipital neuralgia and cervical degenerative disc disease. During the course of Jamieson's treatment, Dr. Cunnington referred Jamieson to a variety of physicians, including a neurologist at Stanford, several other specialists. They all came to the same conclusion. They all diagnosed Jamieson as suffering from severe left occipital neuralgia and cervical disc disease. Ultimately, Dr. Cunnington's RFC assessment was not singular, but rather it was consistent with all of the other specialists to whom he had referred Jamieson. As such, his conclusion, meaning the ALJ's, that Jamieson's ability based on Dr. Cunnington's assessment was inconsistent and extreme simply doesn't hold water.
Did either of the non-examining, non-treating physicians the ALJ relied upon ever see your client?
No, Your Honor. Judge Hawkins, these are state agency evaluators. The files are sent to them for their review. They merely look at the paper file and make an assessment.
Do they have medical records available to them?
In this particular case, Your Honor, it's not clear from the checkbox form what records were before them. I do know, however, that in terms of the timeline, that neither Dr. Torre, who completed the physical RFC, or Dr. Torre, he did not have Dr. Cunnington's RFC assessment. His opinion predated Dr. Cunnington's assessment by several years.
Okay.
So I can't say what exactly he reviewed.
In other words, it's not clear from the record.
To me, it's not, Your Honor. No. I do know, however, that he wrote no narrative and he simply checked off a bunch of boxes. What's significant, however, is that his diagnosis was the same as Dr. Cunnington's. He said that Jamieson did indeed suffer from occipital neuralgia and cervical degenerative disc disease. Where they vary is the level of limitation. And consistent with this court's line of cases in Sprague, Hammock, and Winans, what we have here is simply a difference as far as the degree of limitation. There's no dispute as far as underlying diagnoses. And consistent with Lester and his progeny, most recently Orne and Ryan, in cases like this, deference has to be given to the opinion of the treating physician. The ALJ did not provide specific legitimate reasons for doing so, assuming that there is in fact a conflict. Secondly, the administrative law judge gave outcome determinative weight to the checkbox form of Dr. Ikawa. Again, this is a physician who did not see Jamieson. He merely looked at the file and checked off the box and concluded that his mental impairment was non-severe. Now, Dr. Mortellaro was a consultative psychologist. Jamieson was referred to him by Dr. Oliveri, one of the neurologists that Jamieson had seen. He conducted and wrote an extensive consultative psychological evaluation. He concluded in no uncertain terms that Jameson suffered from chronic pain syndrome. Specifically, he noted that Jameson had significant deficits in various functional areas. At the conclusion of his report, he stated that Jameson was in need of significant psychotherapy. Now, for reasons unknown, the ALJ simply said that, again, he found Dr. Mortellaro's opinion to be extreme and inconsistent with the record. And he gave outcome determinative weight to, again, the checkbox evaluation of the state agency evaluator. He didn't say why, other than saying that he felt that the report from Dr. Mortellaro was extreme. Finally, the ALJ rejected Jameson's complaints. He found problems with his recital of symptomatology. He said they were inconsistent with the record. One of the things that he noted...
Were the testimony at the ALJ hearing from your client about his pain, was it inconsistent with what he had told his own treating physicians?
Absolutely not, Judge Hawkins. It was completely consistent. And if you read all of the recitals from the various physicians to whom Jameson had been referred, the physician at Stanford, Dr. Oliveri, Dr. People, there's no inconsistencies whatsoever. And Dr. Mortellaro, the psychologist, said that there was no evidence whatsoever of feigning or malingering. And none of the physicians who evaluated Jameson on the physical side ever said that there were inconsistencies in his recital of his subjective complaints. There's a timeline and a consistency throughout. One of the reasons why the ALJ claimed that he rejected Jameson's subjective complaints was because he said that an individual as disabled as Jameson claimed to be should have been getting greater treatment. Now, he never said what that treatment should be. And yet, when we look at the record, Jameson, in fact, received a great deal of treatment. Following the injury, he underwent physical therapy for 5 months. He had not one, but two nerve blocks. Neither of them provided any long-term relief. He was prescribed significant codeine-based medications, including Lortab, Neurontin, and Percodan. And ultimately, he went to Stanford, and they implanted a nerve stimulator from which he didn't get very much relief, if any. So how the ALJ could reach this conclusion, given this litany of treatment, is problematic. I'm going to reserve the balance of my time. Thank you, Your Honor.
I think you're right at your 2 minutes. Thank you very much. We'll hear from the commissioner at this time. Counsel?
Good morning, Your Honors. Almond Roth for the Commissioner of Social Security. I'm going to focus on one particular aspect of this decision and see if you have questions. In this case is similar to a 2008 case, Ferrante versus Astru, in which the claimant's daily activities were significant and inconsistent with a medical opinion in particular. In that case, Mr. Ferrante cared for his household and, I believe, a teenage son and hosted a weekly Bible study. In the present case, Mr. Jameson's wife was disabled and he maintained a household of four, raised two children with no significant assistance, and his activities included homeschooling a nine-year-old, performing light household chores, driving his daughter to school every day, grocery shopping a few times a week, driving a stick shift truck loaded with a week's garbage for a family of four to the dump.
How often?
Once a week. Also, he had other activities, but like watching TV, playing some computer games, going shooting once in a while. He went to Reno a few times. But this is not all. As Mr. Jameson himself described his activities and limitations in early 2005 to Dr. Anderson, shoveling snow from his home for an hour caused significant pain. But he had no or only a little bit of difficulty performing less demanding activities such as household chores, climbing ladders or stairs, or driving.
But you think that the individual just needs to sit home like a vegetable rather than to strain to do some things that are useful around the home?
No, Your Honor. But, I mean, all the case law says that once the activities become unsubstantial and consistent with complete disability, inability to do any activity, once you reach a certain level and certain type of activities that are quite significant, for instance, homeschooling a child, I mean, it's not said in the decision, but anyone knows that usually those activities will take a few hours a day and are regulated by the state. So once you reach a certain level of activity and you assert complete disability, inability to do any movement, which is what Mr. Jamieson essentially was saying, yes, it's a significant inconsistency. And this was not the only inconsistency, by the way, because mentioning treatment, Your Honor, which was another inconsistency.
So in effect, we're ignoring all the things that were said by the treating physicians because of the fact he could do some things at home.
Well, he could do some things in the home, and in some cases, you know, when you have some activities that you do despite pain, it may not be an element sufficient to discount credibility of a claimant. But when you do a lot of activities like this claimant, and in addition,
didn't seem to me that really was any lot of activities. It was some activities, and as Judge Fletcher says, you really can't expect a person who is really seriously disabled to just do nothing. So he's trying to do stuff.
Well, you know, I mean, some of those activities are clearly activities that seem by choice, like homeschooling a child. I mean, I assume he could have sent his child to public school, but he was able for a number of hours a day. And I haven't done a complete research, but...
Well, Dr. Cunningham, even just right before the hearing, thought he was completely disabled, and he knew about the things he was doing.
Well, I don't know that he actually said to Dr. Cunnington, for instance, that he was shoveling, that he actually, when you look at the report to Dr. Anderson, he said, activities like shoveling snow, you know, give me really significant pain. And he said, I have to add to reduce activities of that level to only once a week. And what I would like to say, and I'll go back to Dr. Cunnington, this was before there was an implantation of a nerve stimulator. What you will see in this case, that he got certain type of treatment. They didn't go immediately to the nerve stimulator. They even considered surgery that was much more invasive. But they said,
by the way, it's also interesting to me that you bring that up, because the fact the contention was that he didn't do enough to go back to doctors to get additional treatment and so forth. Now you're deciding the fact he had an implant of a nerve stimulator.
Well, what I'd like to say, Your Honor, is they tried him for a long time for a level of treatment that were much lower, and then they were concerned. If you look actually at February 2005, when he was talking to Dr. Barbaro, he was already doing much better. Even Dr. Cunningston's own medical findings were inconsistent with his opinion, because beginning of 2005, you will see, for instance, that he had regained his range of motion in his neck. Okay? And what you will see is...
What do you do about his testimony that he could do these things, but that he would have to then lay down because it was so painful to him, he had to get a rest from it?
Well, you know, I just point out, as I said, if you look at the record, excerpts of record at 171 and 179, if you turn, for instance, this is, I think, quite significant. If we turn to 179, he said that he was able to do a number of activities of daily living with only not at all, just a little bit of pain. And what he said at the same time, that's in the same 18F, same exhibit to the ALJ, he was describing what caused him a lot of pain before he got the nerve stimulator, which was effective. If you look at all the doctors, it was effective. They reduced his medication, so that was effective. And they wanted to reduce his medication because there is some kind of addiction problem with the medication he was using.
If he's seeking treatment and trying to find ways, including pretty invasive nerve blocks and nerve stimulators, and trying to get his medication adjusted so he can live hopefully drug-free, you know, that does not sound like a profile of a malingerer.
No, he is not a malingerer. And, Your Honor, you aren't telling
me. The ALJ thought he was exaggerating his description of pain.
Well, the ALJ, I will put it this way. If you read the decision, the ALJ said certainly the claimant in this case is not symptom-free. And the ALJ did recognize that, and you will see, for instance, in his RFC that he actually took into account by limitation with overhead reaching, because actually this claimant in some of his testimony or his statements said that most of his he had more pain, especially with reaching overhead with his arms. But no, the ALJ didn't say he was a malingerer. The ALJ believed that he had symptoms of pain, but generally, in Social Security, even if you have symptoms, you don't need to be symptom-free to be able to work. And he had still significant symptoms, but he had significant activities. If you look at the medical findings, even in 2004, what you will see is that he had, for instance, a reduced range of motion with head extension. But actually, if you look at the rest of his findings, the findings were relatively normal, and even the flexion of the head when it was either normal or was at 40 degrees. That's in 2004. His claim starts in April 2004 to the date of the ALJ's decision. Then you look at the beginning of 2005, he is seen by Dr. Barbaro. Dr. Barbaro doesn't find anything wrong with him. Then he still has some, he goes back to the doctor because he has pain. They decide they're going to try Neurontin, doesn't work. Then they try the nerve stimulator. He improves significantly with the nerve stimulator. That's a reasonable reading of the evidence in this case. In addition, just before the nerve stimulator, in February 2005, less than 12 months from the time he filed his claim for a supplemental security income, he described what I described to you about type of activities that go way beyond light work, which is shoveling snow, which is what really causes him the most of his pain. And that was and he described his other activities as being just a little bit or no problem. Given the fact that even in February 2005, he wasn't treated with the best treatment, which was a nerve stimulator, and he further improved after that, I submit to you, to this court, that the reading of the evidence by the ALJ I'm sorry, Your Honor.
What bothers me, here's a person who was very seriously injured. The ALJ and the commissioner ignore the treating physicians and what they say in comparison to those doctors who never saw him, checked blocks and so forth. They ignored what he himself said was his ability to do things, and ignored his wife. Now, it seems I have never seen one where everything is ignored in favor of the non-treating physicians.
The ALJ summarized the evidence and said it wasn't supported by the medical records. I will suggest, Your Honor, if you look at two of the specialists that that claimant saw in August 2004, Dr. Peoples and Dr. Olivieri, their findings are not findings consistent with disability. They make a number of findings that are actually normal. Now, speaking about responding to your question about his wife, as we said, it wasn't raised before the district court, but nonetheless, the ALJ sufficiently, she didn't testify, she provided a statement which actually confirmed that he essentially maintains a household by himself. He gets some help from his daughter. She takes the dog outside. Sometimes they clean the dishes. That's all they do.
Okay, our questions have taken you over your time. You're out of time.
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
It should be right in front of you, right there. Do you see it?
Yes, I'm sorry. It
says, light means
stop. I'm sorry, Your Honor.
And no problem.
I apologize.
Thank you for coming in today.
Thank you.
Rebuttal?
Thank you, Your Honors. I want to focus on the remedy in this case. As I noted at the outset, it's Jamison's position that the case should not just be reversed, but reversed and remanded for the immediate payment of benefits. The standard of the Ninth Circuit is very clear. For example, in Beneke, the court noted we have three prongs in situations like this. Number one, did the ALJ fail to provide legally sufficient reasons for the rejection of the evidence? Clearly, that's the case here. Number two, are there any outstanding issues to be resolved? The answer is no. This medical record is completely developed. Number three, if we credit as true the statements of Jamison and accept as true Dr. Cunnington's opinions, would the ALJ have been required to find Jamison disabled? The answer, again, is very much yes. And finally, if we look at the progeny of Ninth Circuit case law, which has addressed this question, the cases have shown a great sensitivity to claimants who have been in dispute with the commissioner for a lengthy period of time. This gentleman was injured in May 2003. It's now June 2009. If this case is not reversed and remanded, but rather sent back for an additional administrative hearing, he may very well not have another hearing for 12 to 18 months. And I think that factor, coupled with the other things that I've noted, clearly warrant reversal for the immediate payment of benefits. Thank you, Your Honors.
Okay. Thank you both for your argument. The case just argued will be submitted for decision.